what did happen? Okay. See, we did crash. It was on this crazy island. And we waited for rescue, and there wasn't a rescue. And then there was a smoke monster. And then there were other people on the island. We called them the others. And they started attacking us. And we found some hatches, and there was a button you had to push every 180 minutes, or... Well, I was never really clear on that. But the others didn't have anything to do with the hatches. That was the Darmans. They were all dead. The others killed them. And now they're trying to kill us. And then we teamed up with the others because some worse people were coming on a freighter. Desmond's girlfriend's father sent them to kill us. So we stole their helicopter, and we flew it to their freighter, but it blew up. And we couldn't go back to the island because it disappeared. So then we crashed in the ocean, and we floated there for a while until a boat came and picked us up. And by then, there were six of us. That part was true.
I came on a plane.
What plane?
A Jira Flight 316. And that's how I returned to the island.
So, why him?
What was it that was so wrong with me? What about me?
What about you?
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast for Season 6, Episode 10, The Package. Lots of stuff happened as we returned to a restaurant in the Sideways this week, but I have a question for our hosts. What type of restaurant did this all go down in? My name's Dave Gonzalez, and Mr. Kimi, this is a Wendy's.
My name is John Robinson. I think we are in a brunch joint called Eggtown. Good thing Kimi's there. He makes good eggs.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I think this, you know, they've got a lot of eggs around, but this is a bakery, and it's called Confirmed Bread.
Nice.
You know, because there was that episode, Confirmed Dead. I think that was the first Kimi episode. I'd have to check it.
Neil's the like, successfully made a Bob's Burgers opening joke in... In our Lost podcast. I enjoy it very, very much. If this is your first time joining us, welcome. This podcast is an ideal companion if you're rewatching the ABC series Lost with us or flashing sideways and visiting the Cork Island for the first time. Because each episode comes in sections for your listening pleasure. First, there is a calm section that only discusses the preceding episodes and avoids all spoilers. And then there's a second section called The Storm. It's a storm of spoilers discussing this week's episode in the context of the entire series and over a decade of Lost fandom. If you look down at your podcasting device or up at your podcasting device, left or right to your podcasting device, some other type of place you might look, you'll see time codes where the calm and the storm are listed in case you want to revisit, jump around. That's up to you. For the final season of Lost, we've shifted to releasing this podcast on Saturday evenings in the U.S. after we do a group live watch in our Storm Slack that you could join by going to patreon.com/stormofspoilers and subscribing at any level. But on that website, you'll find ways to subscribe to us for a monthly fee, and depending on what level you choose, you get more and more bonus content. And when you subscribe for the very first time, like let's say you're not a Patreon and you want to get in there for the live watches, you also get instant access to our previous years of bonus content, which include extra interview bits, bonus podcasts, and various oddities, most of which not having to do with Lost. But there's a lot of fun stuff in there. For instance, if you want to join our Patreon, there's other watch-along events. We are going to get together and watch a movie on the final Sunday of the month. Joanna, what are we watching for the month of July?
So July 25th, mark your calendars now, because I think someone missed Movie Club last week or last month. Anyway, we are doing the movie Sneakers, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. So yeah. Too many secrets. We're going to watch Sneakers together. You can also... Movie Club is not the only way, of course, that you can hang out with us. You can always hang out with other Storm listeners on our Patreon Slack. If you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers and become a Patreon subscriber, you can hang out there. You can look at our calendar on our website, stormpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter, @stormpodcast. Vote in our Kistry poll over there. And you can always email us, host@stormpodcast.com. And you could leave us reviews. So we've got a couple reviews this week. The first one from E_Johns, 5 stars, excellent hosts, excellent rewatch. I came to the JRPU, Joanna Robinson Podcast Universe, by way of Decoding Westworld, because how else do you know what is going on in that show? He says some nice about things about me. Thank you so much. Joanna, Dave, and Neil have great chemistry, and each week when I listen to an episode, I feel like I'm settling in to hang out with friends. I'm yet another listener who was 11 when Lost first premiered, and I found memories of renting DVDs of each season from my local video store to get caught up before the final season aired. This is my first full rewatch since the show ended, and I can't wait to revisit the finale, which I don't think I understood the first time around, with hosts and the awesome community they've created. Can't wait to see where they go next. My vote is Fringe, and maybe an off-season tour. So that was one review, and then the other one, 4 stars from Tunbach, perhaps, who claims Midnight Boys pew-pewed first. Love the pod and the hosts. Love the pod and the hosts, but I also listened to the Ringerverse guys. They totally beat you to the pew-pew punch. I was actually kind of miffed when I heard you all start doing it. Kind of felt like you were biting from Van and Charles. Came with the good work, getting lost. Can't wait for the next rewatch announcement, but it's time to retire the pew-pew. It's the Midnight Boys. I think what's possibly happening here is this lovely listener is maybe somewhat new to our pod, because maybe there was a time when I stopped doing it. But I started doing this years ago before the Midnight Boys segment on the Ringerverse podcast even existed. So, and I have a keychain from our friend Daphne to prove it that she made for me several years ago. So, I think the timeline doesn't add up for me to have ripped that off from someone, but if I did, I apologize. So there you go. So those are a couple reviews we got, and then we got some fun emails actually this week. One is about Iowa, which I'm kind of excited about. So let's start with the Iowa email from Jeff. So Jeff wrote, in a recent episode, Joanna said she could tell the episode was filmed in Hawaii rather than California because of the differences in the palm trees. I think it was the episode LAX and the setting was supposed to be LAX. Well, if you think that was an obvious location tell, I'd like to let you know what an Iowan thinks when they showcase Kate's childhood home in Ames, Iowa. Ames is a real city in Iowa, home of Iowa State University, my alma mater, with a population estimated to be around 100,000 people. The Lost production team, however, portrays Ames as about as rural a community as you can get. Iowa has hundreds of small and very rural towns. Ames, however, is actually one of the 10 largest in our state. In the episode where Kate tries to shoplift and meet Jacob, she's stealing from a gas station named the Ames Central General Store, and it's across the road from a cornfield with a wooden fence that you might see around livestock but never row crops. I'm pretty sure planters and harvesters can't get that close to a fence like that. Labeling it a general store obviously implies a small townness is just calling something central when it's obviously not in the center of anything. This rewatch was the first time that I've seen that episode with captions turned on, and the background dialogue between the woman and the store owner includes the line, "He's gonna farm that land all the way out to Ames Road." The whole scene has sort of a, I've seen the beginning of Wizard of Oz and this is what rural America probably looks like, yeah, vibe. Or maybe even a little House on the Prairie thing, neither of which are set in Iowa, by the way. I'll give the production design folks credit for one thing, though. The blue license plates were spot on for the time. However, they made up the name of the locale. Stamped on them, we have 99 counties in Iowa, but Jeromed 8-1. Regardless, on behalf of all Iowans, we're proud to count Kate Austin as one of us, and probably Cassidy too, as I believe she was likely somewhere near Ames when she met, and Sawyer told her to meet him in Sioux City as part of his con. Keep doing what you do. We all appreciate it. Jeff in Iowa. So there is a scathing takedown of the depiction of Iowa in Lost. Any feedback from you, Neil or Dave?
No. I like this type of rigorous comparison, especially for this period of television. I've just gone through Sweet Tooth, which does New Zealand for Colorado, and was actually surprised at certain points where I couldn't tell. So hopefully television as a overall is getting better at this.
I might, as an Iowan, be slightly offended. Yeah, I think took one of the larger cities and made it quite that podunk. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I think it's one of those things where, like, they needed a town in Iowa. Like, they needed the name of a city that people had heard before. They couldn't actually pick a small town in Iowa because it would be
Jacobstown.
Right. Iowa. It's either Ames or Dubuque. Those are the two.
Des Moines.
Oh, I guess Des Moines, right?
River City. I can named several because Look of the Music you. Man.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, Lost, as we've discussed, has not always been great at understanding like real world jobs, you know, like police and doctors. So why would we assume that they know anything about living in Iowa?
Harvesting corn. I love knowing that you don't fence in a corn. I kind of knew that conceptually. Like if I envision a cornfield, I don't envision a fence around it. But of course, because a harvester could not get there. Anyway, thank you, Jeff. I loved learning about Ames, Iowa. All right. Andrea wrote in to say, I want to add to this long email. She sort of went back and circled to the top and said, I want to add that I was not 11 years old when Lost first aired.
Hey! Oh, thank God. Finally.
I was 24, but I was 41 when I first watched it. I ultimately decided to surpass your podcast and finish this series ahead of you, and just wow. I loved the show and your podcast so much, in fact, that I immediately started a rewatch just so I could go back and listen to all the Storm sections I had skipped. They have truly been such a delight. I know back in season 6 and caught up with y'all again. Is this a time loop? And I have some calm and stormy thoughts I wanted to share. So I've split Andrea's email. We'll revisit some of it in the storm. I want to share one sideways, but not Lost sideways thought first. Y'all originally wanted to compare the endings of Game of Thrones and Lost. I was/am still a huge Game of Thrones fan, and it's the reason I found your podcast in the first place. I rewatched the series, including the final season, several times now, and while the rush and, in my opinion, sloppiness of season 8 is still definitely apparent, the thing that bothers me the most is D&D's complete and utter denial at any criticism of the ending. I've really appreciated hearing the creators of Lost, Damon Lindelof in particular, acknowledge some of the mistakes and regrets they have with the show, and also how they've grown since creating the show. I'll be interested to hear how y'all compare the endings if you end up returning to Game of Thrones. And then
I don't know if I'm expecting the same amount of growth from Weiss and Benioff, just to be honest.
Yeah, we'll see. I don't know. Time is...
They have to go make a couple more shows before we'll truly know.
Life is long. We'll see.
Yeah.
Okay. That's. I think that's all the calm stuff in her email. We're gonna get to... She's asked us to rank the worst characters, and I don't think we can do that in the calm. So I'm
the
say
worst
that.
Characters, and does she specify like in what way? Just
she,
as a little tease,
she supplied a little list here.
Okay, good. we'll get to it then.
So we'll do that in the storm. But so that's it, I think, for reviews and emails in the calm. We've got a bunch of good stormy emails. And just to let you all know that if you want to watch Happily Ever After, which is the next episode, next weekend, Diana will be your guide there. And, you know, as you might have guessed by the end of this episode, we're going to see more of Desmond. So, you know, tune in. So that just leaves me with one question for you, Neil Miller.
Mm-hmm.
What happened on Lost this week?
Well, I would say that a few things happened on Lost this week. This episode, The Package, was written by Paul Zbyszewski and Graham Rowland, and directed by Paul Edwards. It aired on March 30th, 2010, and it takes place on days 8 and 9 following the arrival of Jira Flight 316 on the island. Still days 8 and 9. Really taking our time here. On the island, after explaining to Jin that he needs all the candidates together in order to be able to leave the island, Flock heads to the beach camp where he attempts to retrieve Sun. It goes incredibly poorly. He's unable to convince Sun, who runs away and bonks her head so hard that she loses the ability to speak English. And on top of that, the man in black's camp is attacked in his absence by Widmore's people, and Jin is taken. Just what a poor plan on his part. Back at the beach camp, Richard returns and explains his new plan. They're going to stop the man in black from leaving the island. And in order to get Sun to come along, Jack promises that he will reunite her with Jin and get them on that plane. On Hydra Island, Jin meets with Charles Widmore and gets to see some pictures of his daughter before being told that it's time for him to see the package. A package that, as Widmore explains, is not so much a what, but a who. In the flash sideways, after having their $25,000 in cash confiscated at the airport, Jin and Sun check into their L.A. hotel, not as husband and wife, but as lovers of a more secretive variety. They appear to be having a nice time drinking champagne and doing some significant unbuttoning. That is, until Martin Kimi shows up to collect the watch and money sent by Sun's father. In an effort to make up for the confiscated cash, Sun goes with Kimi's associate, a fluent Korean-speaking Mikhail, to the bank to get the money while Jin goes with Kimi to the restaurant. It is there at the restaurant that we learn exactly how Jin ended up in the freezer, and that Kimi was contracted by Sun's dad to kill Jin for getting involved with his daughter. Before Kimi can kill Jin, Saeed shows up, says no to eggs, shoots everyone, and sets Jin free. When Mikhail eventually arrives with Sun, he is dispatched by the recently freed Jin. In the ensuing gunfight, Sun is injured, and Jin carries her to safety and medical attention, and as he's doing that, she reveals the fact that she is pregnant. It all ends back at the submarine on the island, where Saeed has been sent to spy on Widmore's people. He watches from the water, very wet, in a confident tank top, as they unload a heavily drugged Desmond Hume from the sub and carry him back onto the island. Fun fact, this is a very interesting one. I guess I had blocked this part out of my mind, but I do remember this. In the premiere broadcast in the United States, which took place on March 30th, 2010, as I mentioned, a large red V and a countdown timer appeared in the lower part of the screen during most of the episode, promoting the ABC series V, which stars former Lostie Elizabeth Mitchell. This promotion obscured some of what was happening in the episode, including some of the things Sun was writing on the notepad in her conversation with Jack. Fans were, of course, very upset. Even got to the point where Damon Lindelof took to Twitter, back when he was on Twitter, to express sort of solidarity with the fans who were not so happy about this giant V countdown clock. But it was something that was unique to the United States. Like, it was not part of the Canadian broadcast or the other broadcast in other countries. So, fascinating. I guess that doesn't feel like it would be something that's weird now, because they do that all the time on network TV now.
I think this was so egregious, though. It's funny, I had this in my notes because every recap I read spent the first like three paragraphs ranting about this. They were really mad. And I think especially the part where it's like obscuring what Sun's writing to Jack is particularly egregious.
So, wild time capsule. All right, that brings us to this week's calm question, which is more of a... It's more of what we hope and wish than necessarily uncovering any facts. In the Flash Sideways, Kimi mentions that Mikhail is known for being able to speak something like 9 languages. On the show, we have seen him either speak or understand 5 languages: Russian, English, Italian, Portuguese, and Korean. My question to you is, which 4 other languages do you think Mikhail speaks?
First of all, it's extremely hot. Like, it's so hot that he speaks so many languages. Okay.
So let's see if we can come up with a good list of, like, 4 more languages. I think that he probably also speaks, like probably Japanese.
I was going to say Mandarin or Cantonese.
Yeah, or Mandarin. Yeah, something that's widely spoken. Because if he's fluent in Korean, he's probably been to Asia and traveled all over the place and picked up a few things. Dave, what do you think?
If he knows Italian and Portuguese, one of these has to be Spanish.
Yeah, sure. And I was going to say French as well. Like, he probably has the whole romance language.
Oh, see, I was going to throw in like classic Tolkien Elvish, because one's just made up.
Klingon.
Yeah, I was going to say, also, this is like 2004 Mikhail, so he could theoretically speak Klingon.
But not Dothraki.
Maybe Latin as well. Latin.
Oh, yeah.
Mikhail seems like a raconteur in a way that would, he'd be like, of course I speak Latin, you know?
I mean,
like Sanskrit.
Just the best.
It's Mikhail.
It's Mikhail.
Yeah.
So I figured. Out. Always going back.
It's we Mikhail. Cannot, we can't not begin with some Mikhail talk, you know?
Sure. Yeah. Let's start with Mikhail. Let's stay on Mikhail. Joanna. Can you never count him out? Is he always coming back? Because it looks like he gets shot through the eye.
Okay, he's probably not coming back. I think this is the last we will see of Mikhail Buchanan.
It is great to see him pop up, because at first Kimi shows up with the other dude who was, I believe, on the freighter, but
Yeah, Omar.
Omar was not as memorable as Mikhail. But it's also nice to see Mikhail because he's like an other. He's not necessarily a freighter person, so it throws our understanding of the sideways even more. It's even more mixed up. Besides having a two worlds now where Jin and Sun are attracted to each other here, he does not like make a deal with Sun's father to like work for him and do his dirty work in order to marry his daughter. No, here they have they're having a secret affair that they're okay at, but it does read much more novice bodyguard sleeping with the boss's daughter than the other way around, which was a bit more honorable and traditional from main universe Jin.
It seems like it's something that's been going on for a little while, but also they must not be very good at it because we learned pretty quickly that Sun's father like was all over it, like had full knowledge, close to her bank account. Like,
I've seen a Machiavellian lot of fiction of people being interrupted in the middle of, you know, a romantic bed session, and they do varying degrees of trying to escape or cover up after themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Jin doesn't even get dressed. He walks in the door. He shuts the door. He does nothing more to prepare for any sort of like incoming conflict. He leaves Sun out there with two glasses of champagne. It just feels like an amateurish affair for a person who's supposed to be a bodyguard for, like, a crime lord's daughter.
What did you say? Romantic bed scenario? Is that what you said?
I believe I said a romantic bed scenario.
Well, Jin had been more competent as a bodyguard, we wouldn't have got that great shot where Omar opens the bathroom door and it's just Jin standing there, perfectly still, with his shirt off. He's like, oh, you've been waiting for me?
You decided to check the bathroom?
Oh, no, my foolproof plan of hiding in the bathroom did not work out.
Or at least get dressed. Like, you don't know what's
happening.
He didn't
even bother to put his shirt back on.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, good direction of television, just questionable motivations.
Sure. Amateur bodyguard, I'm with you. I believe. I support you.
Yeah, I also think that if you are like a professional bodyguard, you are having an affair, don't do it in the hotel room booked for the crime lord's daughter. Like, that scene was like, I mean, there's a whole bunch of these plans.
But maybe he didn't he walked in. I don't think that he intended a romantic bed scenario. Sun was the instigator in that situation.
He was trying to go to the restaurant, get this watch situation done so that he could come back and have a romantic bed scenario.
Anyway, otherwise a pleasant sideways that answered a lot of our questions.
Fine. I don't think it's a good sideways, to be honest with you. Like, it's nice to see Sun and Jin together for the first time since season four, like substantially for the first time since season four. But, like when you compare it to something like Dr. Linus or The Substitute, where the sideways feels like it gives us strong emotional development for a character we care about, I don't think I got that for Sun and Jin in this sideways.
No, it's sort of like just a rearranging of the dynamic we know they have, like just thrown into a different like situational comedy.
It's fun because Mikhail's there and Kimi's there, and that's fun. But it's also kind of you suck some air out of it because we know that Jin is going to wind up in that freezer, right? Mm-hmm. We already knew that. So that sucks the marrow at it too, you know what I mean?
Right. And I guess I don't know how complicated they wanted to make the pregnancy reveal at the very end, but it seemed super telegraphed / involved a main universe scene where Jin sees his daughter for the first time, and I think like that really works, but it ends up sort of undercutting any sort of surprise we were going to have, because I feel like that's telegraphed. Yeah. I think it was pleasant. I don't think it was good.
Yeah.
Fine. It was fine, and it's especially tough coming off of Avatar now, which is such a good episode. You don't have to love it as much as I do to, like, it's a special episode of Lost. the longer runtime. They took longer to film it. It's a very special episode. And then they follow up with Sun and Jin, where I just don't know that there's some, like, there's clever twists in it in terms of, like, oh, Sun really doesn't speak English. And, oh, it was her idea to run away with Jin. And, like, all sorts of stuff like that. And, like, the button, the cardigan button callback and stuff like that. But it's not emotionally impactful in any way, I think.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, it feels more like a transitional storyline. Like it's just moving some pieces into different places, sort of getting us to the point where Jin is in the freezer, is the purpose of this episode. It doesn't necessarily feel like, even though they tell us a lot about what's happening with Sun and Jin, it doesn't necessarily feel like it really moves their Flash Sideways story forward, you know? Right.
Yeah, or their main story, because it only really gets us to where the main storyline sort of couple was in the pilot, which is that they're running from her dad, potentially.
Mm-hmm.
There is emotion in this episode, I will say, but it doesn't come from the Flash Sideways at all. I mean, it's distressing when Sun is bleeding and saying she's pregnant. That's upsetting, but it's plot related. It's not character related. Mm-hmm. Feels like.
Right. So
yeah,
man,
what we're here to see is Sun and Jin both looking very hot before Akima shows up.
Yes. In a romantic bed scenario.
Like they're like, all right, so we've kept your characters apart for like two seasons. Now you get to do some scenes together. You're just going to look really hot. And I don't know, sometimes that's probably good enough.
They could have given us a little bit more. They gave us so much Sawyer. We could have gotten a little bit more.
But it's fair.
Before Kimi came in to ruin everything.
So, Jin could have also refused to put on more clothes even after Mikhail showed up.
Spent the rest of the episode.
Just being like, I worked for it. I'm going to show it off. Well, hopefully we have some exciting stuff on the island, right? Maybe?
Yeah.
We pick up back at, you know, Camp Lock, and things are not going well mentally for the remaining people there. Sawyer thinks that he's going to get things together, but Jin's going to get the fuck out of there because he does not trust Locke. The Sawyer's recent caring recommitment to getting people off the island after he got real angry in Otherton. I guess it's hard for me to know if Jin's making the right decision here, if Sawyer's making the right decision. Do you think you could out-con the smoke monster at this point? Neil?
I mean, I think Sawyer's willing to try. It's funny because I kind of find the Sawyer and Kate like moments in this episode to be some of the least interesting stuff that's happening. I'm like, why do we keep coming back to Sawyer and Kate when this is like we don't get a ton of Jin after he's captured? Like we just get this like one scene with Widmore, and Jin is still captured at the end of this episode. And it's really more about the island stuff it's more about like the plan of the Man in Black is beginning to unravel because he can't, you know, he can't control people in the way that he wants to, right? Like he has this conversation with Jin at the beginning where he's like, you know, I got you, Jin, don't worry. I'm going to go get, you know, I don't think he tells him that he's going to go get Sun. He's just like, you know, I promise that I'm going to get your wife back. And Jin immediately after he leaves is like, I'm out of here. I don't trust this guy. So to me, the more interesting part is like watching the Man in Black's plan start to slowly unravel and to see how he's, you know, trying to compensate with that. Like, you know, he gives Saeed a task and, you know,
He seems to position Claire to do some murder in the future.
Right. He's like trying to keep Claire happy. And so that stuff's interesting to me. But it just feels like Sawyer and Kate are just sort of like hanging around on the sidelines. And every time we come back to them, it's like, shouldn't they be doing more? Like their main characters, like Sawyer, we've had so much of Sawyer, and we know he's capable of doing great things, and he's just sort of like chilling while he calculates what he's going to do, you know, and it's kind of boring.
It seems like this episode, I think you're right in that we're seeing the smoke monster's plans sort of hit some more hitches, but as far as I can tell, those hitches are new rules that we get. Which mm-hmm. is
rules. Right.
Somehow we're adding rules.
I mean,
chaos.
So now, in order to get, the first thing I think he tells Sawyer is he can't like fly over the water, so he's got to go to Hydra Island in some sort of form, which I think meshes with everything we've seen with the smoke monster so far. I don't think there are a lot of smoke monster attacks on Hydra Island, so that makes sense. But also, in order to get off the island, apparently he has to have all the remaining candidates who have to leave.
Does
together.
He say it like that? Yeah, I guess he does. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The only reason I remember he says it like that is because it's people whose names are still not crossed off on the wall. So that would be the remaining candidates. And he definitely says all together because that's like vaguely echoing how Eloise got them back to the island mm-hmm. anyway. Mm-hmm. The idea that they have like an increased power as a group or something that breaks some sort of metaphysical rule for this monster. But the new rule is all of them together. So it makes a little bit more sense that we not only have the Widmore problem, and then thankfully, I guess this episode, Richard has decided to make the beach camp also on the team stop the smoke monster from getting off the island. So we're kind of coalescing around where this war that Locke mentions is going, where that dividing line is going to be. And it seems to really hinge on the candidates, because the candidates have to either decide to take over for Jacob and protect the island by stopping the smoke monster, or all decide as a group to get off the island together in order to release this smoke monster. It seems to be the line that we're drawing. So if we go with what Neil was saying, for some reason, even though they seem very capable, he's got Sawyer and Kate and they're staying put. So mm-hmm. they could get knocked out by little darts at the camp. They could fake having hot chocolate to listen in on conversations, but they're not going anywhere. So he's got two of them in pocket. He's got Saeed, who recently, as we discover this episode, doesn't feel anything. Joy, pain.
Fun. Great times.
Yeah.
Love this for one of our favorite characters.
Yeah.
Yep. Definitely just if there was somebody who needed to not have any passion, it was Saeed. So now he's just some sort of predator, terminator, robot thing that is out to kill and gathers information. I have no idea.
This reminds me that when you said he's got Saeed's name was not crossed off yet, right?
Correct.
So he's got Saeed and Kate and Sawyer. And Saeed he has, and he's not in danger of losing him. And Kate is a reason for Sawyer to stay and vice versa sort of thing. But this reminds me of, sorry for this maybe dumb comparison, but how familiar are you guys with the musical Into the Woods? And Into the Woods, the baker and his wife have to collect these various sort of ingredients for this spell that they need to work. And they keep like getting and then losing various ones. And so it's just like he had gin, he lost gin, now he's back to three, you know, sort of thing. So
mm-hmm.
Candidate Watch 2021.
Yeah, keep our eye it's like he's out in the jungle and he's trying to put together a puzzle, but the pieces keep running away every time he puts one down,
or getting drugged and carried away in Jin's right. case because he's not running anywhere. But yes,
right. Well, and Jin, I mean, even before he was taken, Jin was ready to just bail on that. You know,
he was just waiting for his leg to heal, and then he was gonna get out,
hobble off, find his wife. I mean, that's the thing about Jin and Sun is that like of all the characters, they are the least interested in any mm-hmm. kind of destiny. Not that I think Kate and Sawyer are that interested, but like they are 0% interested in anything except finding each other and going home. That's all they care about, you know?
Well, mm-hmm. if this episode does anything to our like forward motion, it is to solidify Sun and Jin back to the main conflict, because on Jin's side, he gets Widmore, who gives him his first look at Jian for the first time on a digital camera, and it's great, but he uses that as a way to connect it to why he needs to stop the Man in Black from getting off the island. Like, if that happens, everyone dies. Ceases to exist, I believe, is what he says. So just, like, mass existence, blink out. Maybe that'll be enough to switch Jin over. The show, I think, wants us to at least ponder that. Meanwhile, on the beach, we get Jack recommitting to Sun that he's going to get... he's going to reunite their family and get them off the island, which would, at this point, at least try to bring Jin over to Jack's side, and we know that Jack's trying to explore just what he owes this island and what purpose, but apparently he now thinks that doesn't necessarily have to involve the Kwans. So we sort remember, of re-anchored, just like halfway through the sixth season, we have to remember why Jin and Sun are part of the story.
Just a quick note on Jack. Remember when Jack figured out his purpose last season? And he was so sure that this was his purpose. And then it went terribly and Juliet died. I think that Sun is very right to not be entirely trusting of Jack's man of faithness now. Because this guy discovers his new purpose like once a week now.
In defense of Jack, I really love Jack in this episode. I think he's actually very, like, his bedside manner is way up from where we've ever seen it before.
That's true.
I think he's really, like, I don't know about making big promises as he's making here. Like, I wouldn't promise anyone anything on this island. But I think in terms of, like, getting her the notepad, figuring out a way for her to communicate, bringing her the tomato, like, all that sort of stuff. Like, this is good Jack stuff for the most part, I think.
It is. So. And when would he have sat down and told Sun that he had to blow up a nuclear bomb because he thought he was just going to blink everything out of existence? I would not tell. I mean, things have been happening.
I guess I'm just saying that, like,
Sun wasn't there for that.
Yeah.
You can see Jack's confidence coming back. In his in the plan, right? In Richard, I guess, in ultimately in Richard's plan, you can start to see Jack's confidence coming back, and once again, not entirely earned.
Yeah, but Jack's confidence. I would say there's a distinction here.
Mm-hmm.
Season six is where Joanna's firmly Team Jack. There's a distinction here in that he's following someone else's plan rather than creating his own plan. Right.
That's fair. That did work out for him in the 1970s.
But, like, I think that he's really trying to do that thing where he's like, what does Jacob say we should do? What does Richard say we should do? Like, that's what we're gonna do. Okay.
All right.
You know? But I'm sure there are plenty of people who would agree with you, Neil. So
we have
keep being tough on Jack. I think it's needed.
We have some additional questionable doctoring, which I'm actually going to chalk up to bad television, not necessarily bad Jack, yeah. But when Sun gets hit in the head while running and not looking through a beach that she used to live on, in daylight, and after an app break where she's just running away and they cut the commercial, we cut back and she runs into a branch. Weird choices.
I didn't realize the branch was after the commercial break.
But then on top of that, yeah, it was like a reverse act break award. Like, when I saw it, I'm like, that is horrible. how many more minutes to V? But I think, like, they keep piling bad decisions on it because it's the most television thing ever to get her hit in the head and she can only speak Korean for...
Stupid. I really hate this aphasia plotline, and I think it's pretty stupid, and I think they at least lampshade how stupid it is a little bit in the episode, right? They mentioned that it's a stupid soap opera-y kind of thing. Howevskies, I will say this. Thematically, the role that I think Sun and Jin have always played is this idea of, like, literalizing barriers of communication, right? Like, in season one, when so much was about, like, these assumptions we make about people and our inability to, like, actually connect and communicate and see their true intentions, their true character, and Sun and Jin, or Jin specifically, not being able to communicate was like an interesting externalized sort of version of that. And so I don't like it. I think it's stupid, but it is at least thematically. What's funny about Sun is she loses her ability to speak English. But what I love about her in this episode is she's just like, John Locke comes to her. She's like, has the complete appropriate response, which is fuck you, no, and runs away, right? And then like it's just like cussing out everyone else to the rest. And she's like, fuck you, and you're playing Alana, and like, fuck you, I'm gonna drive my knife into this table. She's just like, I think she has the right read on a lot of people, where she's just like, this is all bullshit, where is my husband?
Mm-hmm.
So like she's seeing things I think a bit better than a lot of other characters, all the while unable for a part of this episode to communicate with other people. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yes, it's also like Sun has been, she's one of the few people who've been on both sides of the teams so far. And everyone's always saying like, we're going to take you to your husband, or we're going to find your husband. And with that moment where she like slams the knife down on the table and then like full tilt yells at everybody in Korean, I am definitely Team Sun 100%. On that side.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
I just kind of wonder if you could have gotten there with the communication thing, like, without the Korean thing. Like, let her say that shit. Let people understand. Let Richard understand what she's yelling at him. Because I think Richard would understand. He's just talked to Isabella off by a ghost tree. Like, I feel like there is a... They do a weird TV trope and they lampshade it, because the other option would have had just been Sun to point out that no one's actually helping her and we're halfway through season 6. I feel like, you know, like from Dharmaville to here, even Lapidus has been with her, you know, by her side this entire time, but Lapidus hasn't been asking for anything. Sun is consistently asking for someone to help her with Jin. Anyway, I know it's an episode and something that the writers, I guess, had to deal with, but it feels like they also wrote themselves into this weird corner, and their way out of it was aphasia for symbolism. But I also agree with Joanna that by the time we get to Jack realizing how to actually help in the situation, we have the characters where we need them to be. It was just a stupid road to get there.
Agreed.
Speaking of things that I hope Joanna understands from this episode, what's up with Widmore and Jin? Why did Widmore need Jin?
Oh, I don't know.
Well,
it's about it's our favorite new Widmore employee.
It is
needing Zoe, needing some geothermal geological information.
Because he mapped it out during the Dharma Initiative?
Correct. Yeah.
Got it.
Because okay, of all the time he spent out on the islands searching for their friend. Because remember, that was like Jin's thing while LaFleur was
Sun.
He was looking for his wife.
He was looking for Sun and he mapped all the entire islands.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Yeah.
So they have that. They need to know the location of some anomalies, as you know, Zoe's saying, and they want him to take them there or point them out. And also they have the package, who, if we remember, is Desmond. And if we remember, Desmond has, you know, detonated one of these anomalies
he imploded one for sure
to tell the tale. This as we, I think we mentioned in the episode where Sawyer first clocked the locked room, this is a very popular guest for what Widmore had, that it was Desmond. But still, I think as we mentioned before, also like Desmond's absence, longer than Michael's absence, was that right?
Longer than Michael's absence.
People were really, really glad to see him come back in this episode. They're like, oh, there he is. He is going to be in this final season. Yay.
It gets more complicated when you start thinking that, like, hey, what about Penny though, and what about their child, and what's this kind of sucks for Desmond, obviously.
Well, I imagine it sucks for Desmond, but also like Widmore's there, so I'm automatically like, what about Penny and what about the child? Like, I think that's that all comes along with it. It comes a little late in the episode, but I am glad that we have Desmond back in play. and we don't have a weird locked submarine door that we have to worry about.
I'm just glad it wasn't Anthony Cooper again. Anthony Cooper can't always be the answer to what's in the mystery box.
But I thought it was funny that, you know, we've been talking about this since, I think since Javi guessed it on the podcast in season one, or maybe it was season two, when we were talking about Desmond being the answer to what's in the hatch, and this theory, philosophy in the writer's room that, like, the best answer to a mystery is a person. And so I just loved having Widmore, literalize that by saying not what but who. Like, I don't have some old stupid unk in a guitar case for you. I've got Desmond effing Hume here. Aren't you way more excited about that? So yeah.
I mean, definitely better Desmond than, like, I have another Jughead bomb.
I have this dagger that I unearthed. Listen, from a planter bomb.
I found this dagger. The key is you don't let him speak, and hello, Charles. Oh, damn it.
Oh, damn it. Let me take you to this second lighthouse.
Well, I mean, Widmore knows some stuff. He does have the, you know, showdown with Locke, which I appreciate as, like, a little stare down act off on a beach. But we learn that Widmore has, like, vague ideas from leading the others for a period of time of who the Black Smoke is, but we don't know how specific his knowledge is. He's definitely erected pylons, which, as Locke points out, indicate he knows a little bit more than just legends, but it seems like he also has a plan that involves Desmond and anomalies. I also want to circle back. Sheila Kelly, who plays Zoe, we were apparently a little too nice to her, considering stuff that we learned from after we recorded that episode. But if you want to check out a Hollywood Reporter article called Stripped Down, How Hollywood's Favorite Pole Dancing Studio Was Undone by Allegations of Emotional Exploitation and Racial Insensitivity, you could check that out and figure that out. But I think, importantly, we could now continue to point out that Zoe's not a good character. We don't have to pull any punches.
Had to pull any punches. I just wanted to give her context outside of, like, just being called Tina Fake on Lost. But yeah, then we learned even more context, and it's like, ooh.
When we gave context, I was like, oh yeah, pole dancing. And that's reclaiming it, yeah, for, like, women's bodies. It's like, great. And it turns out that was the trap she was setting for people. So I apologize for my part in that. And definitely check it out. It's always good to be more informed. Not always good to look up actors that you like and see what they're doing now, but if we are going to talk about Lost in a contemporary setting, that was important to point that out.
It's well documented that Lost has had some hits with their casting, some just great ones who seem like wonderful people off screen and have gone to do great things. But Lost, as a cast, big cast, also has some extreme misses in there.
Indeed. So let's go back to the beach people, not talk about Sun. We have Alana, who's waiting for Jacob to come around, and gets a nice little conversation with Ben after he comes back from finding Sun, and apparently, you know, being okay. Ben and Alana now seem like buds who could kind of snipe at each other, because she accurately points out that when he's talking, he's probably lying. Good read, Alana. How do we feel about Alana's leadership and continued insistence that Jacob, who seems withholding, if not at least an occasional liar, has never lied to her and still has control over the situation? Joanna, do you feel like Jacob has control over the situation?
His vessels are imperfect. Do you know what I mean? So I don't know. Control is a hard thing to,
I think we definitely are getting an idea based on, like, the things that the people who've been around the island for a long time, Ben, Charles Widmore, Jacob really should have given them some more backstory here.
Yeah, just a bit.
Yeah,
well,
like
Alana
Jacob.
Too, at
Jacob,
this point, she doesn't know.
Right. It's not just that he's, like, withholding, like, tactical information from Alana. It's like we realize in this episode how little even someone like Widmore, who was one of the leaders of the others, really knows about the threat of the Man in Black, you know, and like what the Man in Black is and what he wants to do. It's, you know, as he says, it's like all based on myth. So it's like Jacob just was not a good communicator. And, you know, Alana still believes in him, but I would have given up a long time ago. I'm going to be honest.
Here's what I'll say in Alana's favor, because she not only has faith in Jacob, she says, Hugo will find him, he will track him down and bring him back. And is that not exactly what happened? Mm-hmm. She had completely, perfectly well-placed faith in Hurley. And if someone is believing in Hurley, then I am automatically
Those are pretty solid instincts.
Yeah.
I guess my issue here is we're being given rules from both camps, we have Fake Locke running around telling people rules as it becomes apparent to him, and then we have Alana, who apparently knows some of the rules, but the only way that we at this point as TV viewers can know if it's true is if it aligns with something else that we've either seen happen or seen Jacob do. We've seen the cave walls. We've heard the candidates from the Man in Black. We've also heard the candidates from Alana. Candidates probably mean something, even though Richard had no idea who candidates were. It's that little bit of mysteriousness through deception, where now, if Jacob tells me a rule, or if the Man in Black tells me a rule, I have context for either of those rules being lies that they're telling me to get me to do something. And it's just very confusing to suss out what the end goal is at this point, because there's so many pieces in motion where, like, you know, the Man in Black's herding Losties, and then on the beach side, they're waiting for, you know, Vision speak through flashback. Like, it's a precarious position to be in. I'm glad that apparently war is here, according to John Locke, because something needs to happen to tell me what I need to be paying attention to besides these people. Of course I like the people, but I don't know what game they're playing anymore. This season's been very odd. You know, every season seems to have like sort of a theme. Season one, obviously Desert Island. Season two, we got Hatch. Season three, we investigate the others. Season four, we got Freighter. Season five's Avishy time travel. Season six is rules I don't care about so far. And a sideways universe that is a bit confusing.
And a lot of what feels like wheel spinning on the island side.
Yes.
Like, I made the joke at the top that we're still on day 8 and 9. But also, like, narratively, there's a lot of treading water, especially in this episode. I mean, think about how little, you know, like we said, how little gets accomplished by both Sun and Jin on their respective sides of the island, in what is supposed to be an episode sort of focused on them. Yeah, I mean, it feels like we're being promised some kind of war, and we're still in the lead up to that. We're still in the pre-battle episode.
Nine of Seven Kingdoms.
Yeah. Well, now we're not even there. Like, we're still in the part where they're moving pieces around the board, trying to get everybody in place for some kind of conflict. And, you know, it is easy to end up sort of writing in circles, it seems, with some of these sort of mid-season episodes. And, you know, for as much as I like some of the character moments, that's the biggest problem with this episode, is that it doesn't accomplish a lot, you know, except, as Dave mentioned, giving us some new rules that may or may not actually be rules.
And it feels like it should accomplish a lot, because, as Joanna pointed out, Jack's been through like three arcs since we started this Sun Wants sure. to See Jin arc. Like, we gotta let's divvy up some resolution.
I think I'm most disappointed in Frank. And this is hard for me to say, because, as you know, we love Frank. But at what point shouldn't Frank at some point just look at Sun and be like, hey, Sun, I know that we, for the entire 8 or so days we've been back on this island, the only thing you talk about is going and finding your husband. And I know I haven't done anything to help yet. But why don't you and I just go off to the jungle to try and find, we'll leave ourselves fairly unbuttoned. We'll just be hot and in the jungle and we'll find Jin. Like, at no point, I think that's what what does kind of make the Jack thing work really well at the end, because this is, you know, everyone seems to be like telling Sun they can give her gin back, but this feels like the first person who's like sincerely like, I really am going to try and help you with this. You know, I've seen the lighthouse. I'm ready to go on with my purpose, and I really do want to help you. I'm disappointed that Frank never made that connection, because come on, Frank, what else are you doing? Making quips?
Yeah, not wanting people to talk about bacon after they make a bad bacon joke.
I mean,
instead of defending Hurley against right. Miles' dumb joke. I mean, yeah.
That's Frank. Well, I hate to dump on Frank in this episode, but it's just, you know, one, why hasn't he helped Son? And two, he defends bacon and not Hurley?
Yeah, who that's why Alana gets the points in the camp, yeah. And not wow. Frank for Frank. Her Hurley faith. No, it's funny because it reminded me of in The Sideways, there's this moment where Kimi says something racist, I'm sure, about Saeed, and Omar's like, hey.
I'm Arab.
I'm Arab. Like, the fuck? So, yeah, I wish Frank had said, hey, fuck you.
Yeah.
There's one more note before we move on to corners, and I don't know what it's referencing.
Well, there's two more notes really quickly. I forgot to mention this when we were talking about The Sideways, but like, I'm not in love with lost love of pregnant women in peril. And they put, you know, they
is that love or is it a theme, Joanna?
Is it a theme? What's
is
the
it
theme?
A crutch or is it a theme?
What's the theme? Like, what are the greater truths we're getting at here when we put women and pregnant women in peril? Over
once
over
they
over
have
again?
Children, we don't know how to write for them.
Very, very good. Okay. Saeed and Quiet Fish. Okay, this is a joke that I'm going to explain, and it's not going to make any sense, but I would be remiss if I didn't. When our producer Diane and I were watching Lost her first time through, and we got to this episode. There's this moment when Desmond like falls down on the dock, and Saeed just comes up out of the water, doesn't say anything, and then Diana goes, "Oh, he's playing Quiet Fish," and I was like, oh. "It was sort of like when you said romantic bed scenario." I was like, "Quiet Fish? Is that a game?" And Diana's like, "No."
Yeah, no.
And so now we just say it sometimes, like, oh, he's playing Quiet Fish, as if it's a thing. And it's because of Saeed bobbing up out of the water and giving Desmond the pleading eyes to not say anything and blow up his spot. So
Saeed's amazing. Playing Quiet Fish.
Oh, he's playing Quiet Fish.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, classic, totally, classic game of Quiet Fish.
Gotcha. Totally real thing.
Yeah.
All right, it's time for the corners. Neil, we have an excellent G Keto corner this week.
Yeah, this is a good one. Wanted to highlight, this is a Saeed-based theme. This, I believe, is what is playing as Saeed is describing that he can no longer feel emotions. And the track is named on the soundtrack Saeed After Dentist, which for folks that were extremely online in 2010, 2000, I don't actually know when this original viral video went live, but there was this video called David After Dentist. It was, oh, here we go, I got it. It was came online in like January of 2009, and it's this little kid who had just come back from the dentist and is talking about how he just cannot feel anything. And it's a very funny video. I'm looking at YouTube right now. It currently has 140 million views. Yeah. Today.
I was going to say, I know that's a million at the end of that. Wow.
It is. It's an OG viral video, sort of back from when social media was still in its youth. So kudos to Giacchino, because that is a clever one, because Saeed is very much giving off the same energy when he's like, I can't feel any emotions, and I'm just a hollowed out shell, quiet fish killing machine.
And Locke's like, probably the best, because I'm going to use you as a murder bot.
Yeah, the man in black is like, yeah, that's exactly what I was going for.
Can I do a special segment?
Oh, yeah.
It's called Kristen Tweets, and just a few minutes ago, our friend Kristen Russo, who's doing our social for us right now, tweeted about Ab Eterno. She wrote, now taking theories on how this boat knocked over this very, 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 very big statue. Ready, go. And Someone wrote saltwater erosion and, of course, corrosion from interior oil lamps for loom weaving. It probably would have survived with five toes. a wizard did it. Anyway, some great answers over on Twitter.
A wizard did it. Our jungle of mystery moment goes to Sun's Dumb Aphasia because the interesting choice of plot for your final season, Lost.
The mystery here is not Sun's actual aphasia. It's why did they write this?
Yeah, why did they do it?
Why?
I know. Here's an actress that we've sidelined for a really long time, giving her maybe one, maybe two lines per episode, maybe, if she's lucky. Here's her big episode. Let's give her a really dumb plot. Go down.
She gets hit in the head too hard.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, give us the grace to someday run our own television show that doesn't have to have someone get in the head real hard. the John Locke Memorial Coming Back Award. Joanna, you want to sing this one?
Never count him out. He's always coming back. It's Mikhail.
Yay! Bookending our podcast with more Mikhail. Like,
you
like
love to
it
see it.
Be.
Sad that he got shot in the face by Jin. But it is good. Did you skip one, Dave?
He did.
Oh, I did?
Yeah. Yeah, the one right above the Coming Back Award.
Oh, yes. The Boone Carlyle Memorial Falling Down Award. I'm sorry. We were just talking so much about getting hit in the head. This is going to go to Sun, who falls so hard she forgets how to speak English.
Her post-act break fall.
Her post-act break fall. So important, it needs to top the act.
Yeah, and this one definitely beat out her other fall in the episode, because I think we're aligned on not being a huge fan of the pregnant woman in peril storyline.
Yeah.
The Abs Eterno Award. Hold on, it's also going to Sun, but Sun and Jin for their ultimate button watch sideways scene of some buttoning.
Well, you get Sun's side of it in the unbuttoning scene, and then the next morning scene is just Daniel Day Kim in bed doing that TV thing where the covers are only pulled up to his waist.
Mm. Yeah.
So that he's just right there. So, you know, good job. Good job, episode. You did one good thing.
Through the looking glass, where we're tracking sideways characters, getting glances in the mirror, we get a pretty noticeable Sun one on the hotel room when she's going to answer the door for Kimi. Stops, takes a look at herself in the mirror.
And she's like, what is the significance of this look I'm giving myself? Also, Jin's reflection is shown while being held prisoner at the restaurant, although he himself does not see it.
Ooh. Mm. You gotta look closer for your own reflection, Jin.
Look inside yourself.
Through the looking glass. Oh, we already did that one. The Ben's talking, so it's obviously a lie word. Of course. We're going to give it to Alana, who notices that when Ben's talks, it's always a lie, by saying, because you're talking, because she thinks he's lying. He's not actually lying, and she's not actually lying, but it hit the award so perfectly. There you go, Alana.
Yeah, it's like Alana like brought this award to life.
Yeah.
Inside the show. And we have to celebrate that.
It should be the Alana, whatever her last name is. Ben's talking, so it's obviously Alana.
Alana, Jacob's bodyguard, once burn victim.
Yeah.
The spot the difference corner between this universe and the sideways. Sun and Jin aren't married. Same romance. No marriage.
Alana Verdansky. Sorry, I forgot. Vaguely Russian.
I don't want to say that every week. All right, the Jungle of Kissery moment. This is where we decide, based on your votes, who needs to be kissing on the Island of Mystery. If you go to Storm Podcast on Twitter right now, you'll get to vote on this week. But we need to talk about last week. Joanna, how did we do for Ab Eterno?
Oh, bloodbath. Absolute slaughtering. Bloodbath. we knew this was probably going to Richard in some form or another. We offered up some options. Ricardus and Jacob, 6.4% of the vote. Richard the Man in Black, only 12.1% of the vote. I have to say, if you had been in our live watch, you might have voted for this, because the groundswell of support for Nestor Carbonell and Titus Welliver was pretty strong in that watch, I think inspired by Kristen's presence. The Black Rock and the statue, only 21.9% of the vote. That was a kiss that killed the statue. But killing everyone, like blowing everyone out of the water, including the statue. It's Ricardo and Isabella, 59.6% of the vote. They said Desmond and Petty, who? Ricardo and Isabella.
Ghost kiss.
Richard and his dead ghost wife. Anyway, yeah, there you go.
Oh, Ricardo and Isabella elbowing their way into the all-time percentage
winners. I think we're going to have to do a Desmond and Penny, Sawyer and Juliet, and Ricardo and Isabella runoff. I don't know if there's...
Mm-hmm.
Do we have time for anybody else? We'll find out in future episodes of Lost. Maybe there's a fourth one in there. Maybe not, though. Don't listen to me. The Charlie Pace Memorial Final Words Awards goes to Sideways Mikhail, who says in Korean, which I'm not going to do. I'm going to read the subtitle. No, I don't think so, because if you were the person who did this, you'd have shot me already. And then he attacks Jin and gets shot, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, winning a very impressive win, though, to win the final awards award in like your at least third language that you speak.
Yeah.
That's some legendary Mikhail shit right there.
How great Mikhail is.
Right. You know? Cause you would have to assume that Russian obviously is his first language and you know, English was probably number two and man, at least third.
The Frank Lapidus, guess we're not going to Guam Act Break Award, goes to Locke. He says to Charles Widmore, a wise man once said that war was coming to this island. I think it just got here. Bum, bum, bah. And once again, jeers to the act break that is just Sun running to pick up with her running. Ooh, bad television. The official podcast check-in, we're not going to have one this week. It was a short podcast because in real time in the past, David and Carlton were about to fly out to actually be present for the filming of the final episode of Lost. Instead, they mostly just tease next week's episode, which isn't a big deal to us. Because we're doing a rewatch. If you are also doing a rewatch, you could stick around for the storm right after this.
All right, now is the time on the podcast where we like to scrawl our own names on a cave wall and thank folks who subscribe to our Patreon at the $10 level or above. Maybe you're on a cave wall. Maybe you're on a weird wheel in a lighthouse. Maybe you're somewhere else. Maybe you're just in our hearts. But for now, we're going to thank these folks, starting with some newcomers. We've got Jen, Rob, B, Jacob, Melanie, Christopher Vanjanek, Gabriel Colorado, Kate Thrams, Jeff Ruberg, Laura Achu, Reginator Cakes, DJ Empirical, Phil, Jackie Meme Lord, Jessica Lair, Matthew Punamale, David Koplos, Lily Lim, Derek Doc, Louise Collins, Philip Durrett, and Tyler Iman, thank you so much.
And I would like to add to those thanks Karen Frost Arnold, Gregory Gregirin, Brandon Lee Tenney, Kelly Stollard, Melanie Rodriguez, Sarah Carmichael, Spencer Howard, Michael Sample, Rosa Peretta, Ashish Sridharan, Blake Burge, Benjamin Smith, J. Ann Atwood, Christina Watkins, Melanie Chu, Dan Janes, Richard Sobel, Laura Caruso, Ashley Warren, and Christopher Renault. Thank you very much.
And I would like to thank the following fine humans. Sarah Wingo, Gwendolyn Gardner, Stephanie Breitbach, Bronwyn Beck, Asiya Glover, Kelsey Elmiger, Jennifer Barrett, Grace Vassington, Liz Wilson, the incredibly easy to pronounce Paul Cole, Claire D., Sarah Halliday, Javier Ernesto Fuentes, Kristen Plant, Mark Marquez, Kyle Davis, Sean Nee, Matt Thompson, Zoe Fuchs, and Sharon Deegan. Thank you all so very much for being candidates on our cave wall.
And we're back for the storm, trademark pew. Pending pews.
Pew, 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 pew.
Hey.
I did double check that pew, pew has been on Urban Dictionary since at least 2006. So I think it predates everyone.
Oh, no. I definitely didn't come up with it. Yeah. I wasn't saying that.
But it definitely was not invented by a Ringer podcast that started in 2018.
I was saying before this podcast started that this episode has it's always going to suck. Not only because it just is shoehorned in, I think, at the wrong point, but it's always going to sit between Abaterno and next week, Happily Ever After, which begins the process of waking up because Desmond, multi-universal traveler, is back in the show. So how is this not going, like, what had to happen in this episode for it not to be a complete bust? I think it's really weird that this entire season broke this way, where they just kind of forgot about Sun and Jin.
Yeah. And, like, I mean, the thing that I think we should start by talking about, that Jack promise, which Neil was trying to, like, get at, but I kind of knew why you were getting at it, because, sure, like, it's a really painful thing to watch Jack swear multiple times to Sun that he is going to get her and Jin off that island, and she and Jin do not get off that island, and that's the most Jin will ever see of his daughter, is on a shitty digital camera from the 2000s.
It's a lot tougher on a rewatch.
Yeah,
than it really will be for our first timers, I think.
Yeah.
Instead of getting them very invested in what was happening on the island, they decide that the hook is they get to be together again. But I feel like if you would have given them that hook earlier, then there would be room for them to, like, for Jin to actually care if all life is gonna, you know, get snuffed out or something like that. That sort of reversal back so that they're part of the team-based plot might have worked, but it's too late. It's too late at this point. Like, it's been years since we've seen them together. And even though for Sun, it's also been, what, 3 years, 8 days or something. It's
Oh, Sun and Jin should go in the Kiss Tree Pool. Damn it. I keep forgetting them. Like the show, I guess.
Yeah.
I did this Twitter post where I posted like four photos of lost couples. And I was like, these amazing couples. And it was like Rose and Bernard and Isabella and Richard and blah, blah, blah. And I forgot Sun and Jin. And then I hastily followed up with like a gif of Sun and Jin. And then anyway, a lost account called me out. I was like, you are right. You are correct.
To be fair, the show did the same thing.
Well, I mean, listen.
I kind of forgot about Sun and Jin.
This whole Sun and Jin thing is quite traumatic for the audience, like how badly they botch Sun and Jin's storyline here at the end.
Yeah.
So it's understandable to have blocked a little bit of that out, because it's like, oh, right. Now I have to remember that they not only kept them apart, but as soon as they get back together, they both fucking die and never see their kid again. Well,
okay, so this
is wild.
I hesitate to bring this up, but I think this is I have heard Damon Lindelof talk about characters who are introduced in context of other characters and how you then can't write that character out of the context of the character. And then I've heard him later sort of change his mind about it. But, like, that was really telling to me, because I'm like, yeah, if you think that way, if you think that you can't have a Michael without Walt, or if you think that you can't have a Claire without Charlie, then you're not going to have them without the other. You're not going to know what to do with them. And so, like, for better or for worse, Lost is often these shows about pairings, like foils or romantic pairings or whatever it is. And that gives us some of its best work. But also when that idea of, like, almost like a forced dyad sort of way of thinking about characters, it limits you if you're thinking only in that way, because then you can't give that character life outside of this partnership. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing, they can't think of anything to do for Sun and Jin but to separate them. And they can't give them anything interesting to do separate from each other.
It's bad for Sun, obviously, because of what she was outlining, but it's also worse for Jin, because at least Sun got to, like, have her own storyline off island.
Mm-hmm.
Jin,
well, and I,
his only beat is to get back to Sun. So much so, like, as we pointed out, he mapped the entire island to try to find Sun.
Right. Yeah, I would say that as well. Like, there was a period initially when they were separated, when Sun makes it off the island and Jin doesn't, where they were able to sort of keep them somewhat interesting. You know, I know, like, Jin's whole role with the Dharma Initiative was, like, he's out there searching for Sun. But they still found a few interesting things to do with him. They found some interesting stuff to do with Sun off the island. it's a problem that gets really compounded when you have to bring both characters back to the same island in the same time. Because now it's just, it's even more egregious that, that they couldn't figure out a way to write themselves into having Sun and Jin together, you know, for some story reason, like get them back together. I would have even said that, like, if they had found a way to reunite Sun and Jin earlier in season six, the fact that they don't make it off the island is a little bit easier to take, but still not great, you know?
Right, but it's the episode before, or same episode where they die? I forget.
Pretty much. I mean, it feels like it's like they meet, they get back together, and then almost immediately die. You know? It's like this constant, like, it's like a funnel of bad decisions.
It's so bad. But I wanted to talk about this idea of also of arcing out. This is something that I stole from Loki showrunner Michael Waldron, who got it from Dan Harmon. This idea of like a character arcing out of your ability to write story for them, mm-hmm. which is why they sort of reset Loki a bit on his own show, right? Because he had already arced out through Ragnarok. He'd gone through the evolution that we've been hoping for him to go through. Mm-hmm. And like Sun and Jin, their arc was about like finding each other again, which they do. Right. And then the show was like, okay, they've arced out. Like they connected. They were deeply in love. They all secrets were bare, you know, revealed, except for the fact that Sun killed Dave Smoothboy. You know, like all of that comes out. And that's some of the most beautiful Sun and Jin stuff is like the stuff where, you know, he finds out she's pregnant. He's talking about being a better man and all that sort of stuff. It's really powerful stuff. But then they're like, and now we don't know. And now it's just, let's separate them. That'll be tough. And it is. Like, and we talked a lot about Yoon Jin Kim's performance, like in the helicopter when she thinks Jin is blown up. But like, you know, but like, these are interesting characters and good performers. And you can have them do a lot of stuff. Like Jin being in Trisha Tanaka's Dead. That's a great, like, fun performance from Daniel Dae Kim that has nothing to do with Sun, you know? And so I just, and Jian, like the stuff that Sun does, they have with Sun and Hurley, that stuff is really powerful. But yeah, I wish that Lost weren't so locked into this idea of like, it's not always that way. Characters are malleable, like, but yeah, anyway.
Yeah. And that, it's also, they don't give equal weight to, like, children. Like, we're hearing all the fucking time about Aaron. Like, I get it. He's special. He was born on the island. But they like, bring Jian back up for this episode because it's the Sun and Jin episode. It's not part of either of their, you know, quests. Up, like, they're not regularly bringing up the fact that the ultimate goal is to get back to the daughter. That just kind of comes and goes because this it's is not the, as important.
Speaking of the Game of Thrones comparison, this is the kind of forgot moment. It's like mm-hmm. the show kind of forgets that Sun and Jin have a child.
Yeah.
That they should get back
That's
to.
That's the worst part of their death.
Yeah.
Honestly. We'll talk about it when it happens, but the fact that Sun has to die because she's trapped, okay. Hate it, but okay. Jin dies so that Sun isn't alone and kind of forgot that he has an entire whole ass daughter back right, home who would right. like to have at least one parent make it back off the island, maybe.
Are we close to making an Andrea list of worst characters by talking this out?
Sure. By the way, I was looking it up. We can call that obviously a lie award, the Ilana Verdansky Memorial in two episodes if we want to.
Woo!
The Ilana Verdansky Memorial, Ben's talking, so it's obviously a lie award. Two episodes to go. All right, here are Andrea's candidates for worst characters on Lost.
Just overall worst characters?
She said, okay, now my first Lost thought question is this. Who do you think are the most despicable characters on the show? I decided to list all of mine out as I collected all their names during my rewatch. Please note I have strong feelings on some of them. I didn't want to include the obvious ones like Christian Shepherd, Anthony Cooper, Charles Widmore, and sometimes, most times, Ben Linus. So here they are in order of appearance for most part. Walt's mom.
Wow.
Roger fucking Workman. Charlie's brother, Liam. Boone's mother/Stan's stepmother. Son's father. Kate's mom. Kate's stepdad. Claire's psychic. Claire's baby daddy. Sawyer's friend who tricked him into going to Australia to kill the wrong guy. Sarah's fiance before her accident. Oh, yeah. Sarah's fiance.
Man.
Remember that guy?
Yeah.
The guy who tried to force Yemi to murder a man and then kidnap Mr. Echo. Goodwin's wife, Harper. Horace in the show and in real life. Vomit emoji. Phil. Rodzinski. Eloise Hawking. Kimi. Bram. And Randy Nations, who is a complete dick in every timeline, universe, and job he's ever in. what do you guys think? I mean, or you can add your own.
It's a really good list.
It's a fun list.
I'm going to add the Hydra other judge who orders that Juliet be branded but never comes up again.
It's funny because Andrea mentioned in her email that she was excited about that actress because she's in the film Mommy Dearest, and so she was so excited when she showed up, and then she just
never is back again. Told Jack what his tattoo meant and fucked right off.
That's what she said beyond translating Jack's stupid tattoo. Pickett? Danny Pickett?
Oh, yeah. Pickett sucks.
Danny. Yeah, he's rough.
Mm. Who else? This is fun. You can email us, hostthestormpodcast.com. I really like the minor character options, if you can remember. The Terminator who sent Sawyer to Australia.
Oh, sure. Rob McElhenney's character. Who sort of sucks the whole way.
Yeah, that guy does suck. I do like the thing about Randy Nations because Anthony Cooper is maybe not a bad guy in the Sideways. Like some of these
We don't know. In the main timeline, Anthony Cooper pushing your own So stealing your own son's kidney and then pushing him out of a window, paralyzing him. That is some, like, next level
About sending your daughter on a trip with her bodyguard boyfriend so that the boyfriend can get murdered, presumably in proximity to her, and draining her bank account?
Yeah, son's dad is also
he's
this fucking list.
Number two. Anthony Cooper, number one. Mr. Pike, number two.
Yeah. No, I think
Jin's,
this is fun.
Jin's mom. Sucked.
Jin's mom, great.
Jin's mom sucked.
So yeah.
Jin's dad's still one of the few good dads on this entire show.
Yes. And you know, Roger Workman's better in the Sideways. Like all these few of these get a better turn of the screw in the Sideways.
Jack's Harper. Grandfather Ray seems like a real piece of shit.
Oh yeah, Ray. Fucking Ray, making it all about him.
But that might also be me imprinting a little bit of that actor's character from Justified as well. Exactly. I just have
Arlo
a revulsion.
Arlo Gibbons sucks. All right, so that is Andrea's list, and I have a couple other things I want to hit. I do want to read a line from Alan Sepinwall's recap, which says, "I think I may be just as invested in seeing the Kwan family get their happy ending as I am on guard that Desmond Penny and Baby Charlie sail off into the sunset."
So, oh, no, Alan.
Oh, no.
Oh, no, past Alan. That's about to be an emotional roller coaster for you, bud.
All right, this one comes from Matthew, a frequent emailer, who says, "I thought it might be interesting to look at the Man in Black in light of our favorite biblical text, Job, to see what kind of Satan figure he might be. Although people often talk about the story of Job being a clash between God and the devil, it's more complicated than that. The character featured in Job is named Satan. But the idea that Satan is the devil is not present in the original text. It's a biblical retcon. Satan just means the accuser. Like workman, it's a job description and not a name." Just learned that fun fact. Thank you, Matthew. For the original author or authors of Job, Satan seems to have a role where he goes around making accusations. As far as I know, it's part of a later Christian tradition to see Satan as the devil. I thought it might be interesting to take those two views of Satan and see how the Man in Black matches up to them. According to Jacob, the Man in Black believes that everyone is corruptible because it is their very nature to sin. That sounds very much like Satan as the accuser. As does his line from the incident, they come, they fight, they destroy, they corrupt. And Locke, to me, sounds very sincere when he says that he was a man once and all he wants to leave the island. Pretty relatable low-key stuff. But Whitmore thinks that if Locke gets off the island, then, quote, everyone we know and love would simply cease to be. And similarly, Isabella thinks that if he leaves, everyone will go to hell. It's not clear where they're getting their information from, but it seems like they are seeing the Man in Black as more of a powerful devil-style figure. Right now, it feels like the show is giving us contradictory views. He's either just a guy who wants to leave the island, or he's this huge evil figure with world-ending powers. It's not clear to me whether the first view is Locke lying about his intentions, or whether the second is Jacob propaganda, or somewhere in between, I guess, Matthew. So I thought that was really interesting, and I think it is a question of, like, you know, we have these people, Isabella and Widmore. I'm trust Isabella more than I do Widmore, telling us, like, of the Men in Black's intentions. And I guess, is it okay if I say what my first response is?
Oh, yeah.
I'm tempted to be sympathetic to the Man in Black, especially as he's played by Titus Welliver, until he puts that bomb on the submarine and Son and Jin die and Saeed dies. And it becomes clear, you know, he needs all the candidates to die in order to get off. And so the fact that he is willing to kill Son and Jin, let's say, who don't have any blood on their hands versus maybe you can make a case for Saeed if you want to, but Son and Jin, to get his goal is, you know, I'm going to put him beyond the accuser into Devil Horn's territory. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty dark to then walk that back to what we see him do in this episode, which is just, like, straight up create this lie of, like, I need all the candidates with me to leave the island, when in the back of his head he's like, yeah, I need all the candidates with me so that I can murder them and then leave the island.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think that puts a real darkness over it. I mean, you know, it's this idea of a villain who is relatable to a certain extent for a long time, and season six is sort of selling us these different stories around him to sort of soften him up and be like, well, wait, what if this is just a dude who wants to get off the island? But of course he takes it too far. You know, that's the classic narrative trick, right? Is eventually he's going to take it a little too far, you know?
Yeah, I think he could be both accuser and devil. I mean, it definitely, like, that whole period of time we were trying to debate if he lies, or like that sort of like pouring honey into your ear and stabbing you in the side and the same sort of mentality. It's very attractive, but if we talk about that as like sort of a force anti-God, like it is in Job, it's not the ultimate pushing things over the edge. That would be something like a devil or what Joanna's saying when it's ultimate. It's like, now I do this because I need to win.
Sure. There's a version of the devil that's more of like the ultimate con man, right? Like he's just trying to like get everybody to do a little bit of evil.
Yeah.
Or trying to pull one over on people, you know.
There's a version of the devil in like Lucifer that is like on the side of mankind.
Sure.
Versus an authoritarian god, you know?
Well, I think Man in Black gets there when he's, you know, helping the people build the donkey wheel, and then his mom's like, fuck no.
Yeah, and presumably he had a wife there, or a partner at least, because as long as he's not lying, he said that he did. I think that maybe he goes through many different phases of devilry. And yeah, that sort of Lucifer version is the version we see in Across the Sea, and then we get other versions of him, the accuser versus. And I mean, I will say this, okay, as much as it breaks my heart to see Sun and Jin die in the submarine and Saeed as well, and other bad things that happen to people along the way, when you're an immortal, as Jacob and the Man in Black, I only know this from vampire lore, so forgive me, but like, if you're an immortal, I suppose like human lives start to seem pretty insignificant. Because they die like fruit flies, right? Compared to your lifespan. So I'm not excusing it, but like, the weight of what he's doing. I mean, Jacob certainly doesn't give a shit if people die in his little grand experiment. So I guess that's the thing about the Man in Black, is like, it's not necessarily always about like, how evil is he or what kind of devil is he? It's like, what kind of force is he in opposition to? Speaking of force dyads, right? Like his opposite is Jacob, who also supremely sucks. So I don't like casting him as completely the devil when Jacob is out here making these also terrible calls, you know?
Well, I sort of like the thing that we've come to over a couple of different like Storm emails, where it's like the light is like some sort of time. And if you uncork it and you let like this anti-time force out to the world, it actually like fucks up all of time. That's what Widmore is talking about like ceasing to exist or whatnot. Instead of the island being able to jump through time or jump people through time, it sort of like all leaks out and becomes like this, I don't know, the Loki version of chaos multiverse effect.
It would corrupt the sacred timeline.
Yeah, basically. But it also seems like, you know, he is, I still like the reading that in this form, the Man in Black is the like scarred nature of Jacob killing his brother, like being exposed to this time force and creating like a smoke entity. So just the idea that it feels like it's traumatized and it really wants to get off, and that's valid, but what it doesn't realize or doesn't care about now, because it's a fucking god being, is if it does get off, it's like the anti-life equation. The thing that like makes it more difficult is that Isabella talks about it being hell in a season that literally has a heaven we get to see. So there might actually be a metaphysical aspect to it, but they never, maybe thankfully, they never bring the Man in Black and Jacob to that metaphysical level.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing, is like Isabella is a source I trust more, and I said this last week, but like more than any alive human talking to us. The virtuous ghost wife, you know what I mean? all right. Do you want to hear Chrissy's email?
Let's.
Oh, speaking of, I just had in, just to mention really quickly in the Storm section, that like John is talking to Claire about why he needs Kate, right? And it's like, yeah, I think he knows that Jack doesn't get on the plane if Kate's not on the plane, right? Like,
yeah.
That's his best shot at getting Jack. All right.
Yeah. So, well, and then, I mean, it also feels like that's, he needs Claire to have Kate.
Exactly.
To get Jack.
Exactly. It's the old lady who swallowed the fly. Yeah. No, totally, totally. All right. Chrissy writes, I was definitely not 11 when I watched Lost for the first time.
Woo!
And I'm older.
Yeah.
And I'm older than all of you. I'll take one for the team. I was so excited to hear of all the discourse from Chris B., Pat, and you all on the mystery of mothers and babies dying on the island and who or what might be its source. When I wrote to you about LaFleur, I had difficulty fine-tuning my thoughts, and consequently, Dave misunderstood me, but I wondered if ultimately the island was responsible. Wouldn't the island's magic overwhelm Jacob's if the island took a side in this particular battle? Pat's theory that Mother's magic could be involved is quite delicious, though. A question to prompt more discourse. Was anyone else disappointed that Widmore was unceremoniously shot and there was little resolution of his story? I would enjoy more fleshing out of the story of the origin of the others, rather than introducing a new group of others, all that temple crap, the cult of Jacob, and not Tina Fey. You've touched on this and will likely say more during that episode when it comes, but this deficiency in the storyline, in the storytelling, really struck me in this rewatch. And then Christy ends by saying, undoubtedly, you need to take on the leftovers next. So, yeah, so the lack of a resolution for Charles Widmore, lack of clarity on who the others are.
Mm-hmm.
Do you care about that? How much do you care?
I mean, it does feel messy narratively that they seem to have a good grasp early on about who Charles Widmore is, sort of what his goals are, what his interest is in the island. And I think up until the point where we have that moment where he and Ben are like, we're going to battle over, you know, the rights to the island or whatever. I feel like he's a really strong character, and they really lose their sense of what to do with him in this final season. And, you know, it's similar to what they do with Desmond, where it's like, all right, we need to bring Desmond back for the final season, because we have this, you know, we have this great role for him to play in The Flash Sideways, but then his on-island stuff is, he's in a well.
He's down a well.
Right? So, like, they bring Widmore back, and it's like, all right, we're bringing in this guy who is like an overpowered piece on the board, right? He's got all this money. He He's got a lot of knowledge about the island. We find out later that he's got the fucking time travel diaries. And he's not very effective, given the power that he should hold, you know? So I think they really, they sort of lose... They just couldn't come up with a good way to bring Widmore back into this. Because I think, like, right here, this beach scene where he's, like, having this standoff with Flock is, like, maybe the coolest, like, that Widmore... It's, like, his peak. But he doesn't seem to really have a good plan for what comes next, and he's fairly ineffective against the Man in Black, so... I don't know. They probably could have just left. Like, it would have been funnier to me to, like, get to the end of the series and then this is, of course, my 2020 cinematic universe poison brain being like, save Chuck Widmore for, like, the post-credits scene on the final episode. And it's like, everybody's gone. Everybody went to heaven. Jack's dead in the jungle. And then Charles Widmore shows back.
Charles Widmore's sub pulls up.
And there's your sequel, right?
Ooh, I like that.
But
Or Charles Widmore finds a way to contact Penny, who sailed off into the sunset with Desmond.
Sure.
And he goes, what about me? And she goes, what about you? What about you, Dad?
Yeah, and then we see his sub roll up to the island. That's great.
Lost.
But yeah, I just don't think they knew what to really do with Charles Widmore here at the end, but they felt compelled, like, to bring him back, you know?
Yeah. We want him back, but we don't know what to do with him. And I am so much more curious. I mean, we all, except for Pat, agree that the temple is stupid, but I would be interested, like, who were Jacob's first followers?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how did it grow into this, like, city others versus jungle others? You know what I mean? Like, show me the org chart. Show me all of that. I'm interested. So, I don't know. This we're very down on the show in this episode, but let's remind everyone that we love this episode. We just raved about it last week. We will be really excited to talk about Desmond and Charlie in the Sideways next week. So we just got to hang through this episode. All right. This email comes from Dan. It's titled Quanundrum. Real Giacchino level. In fact, there probably is a Giacchino track called that. Anyway, Dan writes, hello and welcome to a kind of stormy, warmy email. First of all, love all three of you. Thank you. Longtime listener / interactor on Twitter, possibly first time emailer. Anyway, just listened to the Recon episode and I was particularly stirred by Michael Schur's analysis of the Sideways. The balance of good and evil has always been at the heart of the show, and though I don't necessarily believe all the candidates were somewhere between one light, one dark, hello Hugo, I do think this works very well with the Quans. Considering that Jacob's lighthouse portal showed the site of their union rather than their childhood homes, perhaps their candidacy was based on the idea of them inheriting conservatorship, yikes, sorry Brittany, of the island together. Balanced. Aside from season one, Jin is pure love / devotion character, where Sun is a little dark and ruthless without him. That's a little headcanon from me. I love what you do and can't wait to see what you do next. Sorry, I turned off autocorrect to try and reclaim my humanity, and I no longer want to push shift to capitalize my eyes on my cell phone. Thank you so much, Dan.
I love this one.
I love this. What it's, like, yeah.
Because the show, especially this episode, spends a lot of time asking which Quan is the one that's on the wall. And at no point, I think, in all the times we've discussed this, have we ever considered that it could be both. And that's great. Now I want my Lost spinoff to be, it's set right after Jack dies, and it's Sun and Jin, having survived the explosion, roll up on the beach. And Bernard and Rose are there. And they're like, oh my God, you made it. And they're like, yeah, we did.
Did you have a daughter? No.
Don't worry about our daughter. We've transcended parenthood at this point. We are now in charge of the island. See, even I forgot that they had a kid for a second.
Oh, Neil kind of forgot about Gian. Oh no. Oh my God. What do you think, Dave?
I like it. Only because we don't actually get an answer in the series that blow them up before Jacob has his fireside chat. But I also feel like the show, if it got to that period of time, would have been like, it's Sun.
I mean,
yeah, probably. Though I mean, I just really like that idea of like, I mean, the reason the mirror is tuned to their wedding location is to keep that mystery alive, right?
Right.
But I like that as we could take it as an answer. I feel like this is an answer that doesn't feel unsatisfying.
No, no. I mean, it feels like something the island needs. If anything, Jacob's just too single-minded with his, like, one-for-one switch that it, like, wouldn't have worked. But I like the idea of a Quan Island.
Welcome to Quan Island. All right. So, one last email from Jen. Jen writes in, first time writing in, but a stormie who watched Lost during the original airing. My mom and I actually had a sadly lost, pun intended, notebook of questions we wanted answered. I read Jeff Jensen and some other theorizing during the show, but I remember that I was emotionally satisfied by the ending at the time. This rewatch is my first rewatch of the final season since then, so I'm interested to see how I feel at the end of this go-round. A memory from watching the final season in real time, I loved theorizing and speculating, but for the final season, I decided to try to avoid spoilers at the end. Back then, I was a loyal reader of IO9's morning spoiler column. I remember that column. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think they might still have it, but I remember who used to write it. Anyway, and remember that they moved any Lost spoilers or reports to the end of the column so all the Losties could avoid them. I cannot think of another time or fandom that received such consideration beyond a normal spoiler alert. Lost was something really great. Anyway, I'm a little behind, but I have some thoughts about ideas brought up in your coverage of the episode Dr. Linus. Thinking about the seeming inconsistencies of Jacob's touch granting immortality. Perhaps the key is the fact that Richard cannot kill himself, but other people, specifically candidates, can kill him. Dogen could have been a newer immortal, but Saeed killed him. Like, so maybe Dogen was also immortal, but Saeed killed him. John Locke was going to kill himself, but Ben was the one who actually killed him. If John had not been interrupted, perhaps he would have discovered that he was the next Ricardo-like immortal via Jacob's earlier touch. Thanks for such great insight. Don't tighten up and don't fall down. So basically, you're immortal unless a candidate kills you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Jacob loves weird rules. So, like, I'm not opposed to it. What do you guys think?
Well, and the show doesn't give us anything super special about the moment when Jacob touches Richard. Like, Richard, he makes this little wish, and then Jacob just touches him on the shoulder. So now, that's another one of those rules that feels a little flexible. So it's like, well, is it just Jacob touching you? Does it have to come with the wish? Does Jacob have to, like, think, I'm making this person immortal, and then touch them?
Does Jacob have to be holding the dagger while he's
right.
touching you?
Or is it just, like, anybody that Jacob touched is immortal now? And I kind of like, that's like a fun version of it. And
but that's everyone, right? That's all the candidates that we saw.
Well, he didn't touch all of them.
That makes me feel better about the islandy shit that happened off island, like Jack being unable to commit suicide and Michael being unable to shoot himself.
Mm-hmm.
Like that does make me feel better about that little loop.
Yeah, and I think for the longest time we interpreted that as like the island won't let people go. But I guess you could also, like, literalize that as, like, these are the people Jacob touched.
Jacob is a possessive and jealous lover.
Yeah. And he could have given them fair warning, though. Like, hey, when I touch you, you're not going to be able to die anymore.
This is my no suicide touch. No suicide. All right, see ya.
All right, I have one last thing to read to you, and it's actually yet another response to Kristen's How Did the Black Rock Knock Over the
Love
Statue.
It.
This one comes from one of our most active Slack users, Phil, who's the best. Phil says, the statue was full of dynamite, which blew up the statue, and then more dynamite fell into the boat after.
Hey, there we go.
Now we know how the dynamite got on the slave ship.
Wow.
So there you go. I think that's all of that. I want to reiterate in case I didn't. The reason I was really excited to read Jen's email, other than the fact that she seems lovely and amazing, is the title Flavors of Immortality, which I just think is an incredible, incredible phrase. So thank you for that. But yeah, please send us hoststormpodcast.com. Please send us your candidates for worst character, worst minor character, worst any character.
I believe it was most despicable.
Oh, most despicable character.
I like and the specificity of that.
Also, your thoughts on what kind of devil the Man in Black is. That's a good prompt, too. And we will read them out next week.
All right.
That's all I got.
Speaking of next week, Neo, Where are we headed?
Well, Dave, we're headed to our happily ever after, now that Desmond has returned to the island. This is Desmond episode, and I think as you mentioned, at least as far as I remember, this is where the Flash Sideways gets really interesting, especially for our Calmies.
When, like, it gets evanescency.
When it's like, oh, wait. What do you, they can up.
Wake me up inside.
Wake me up.
Can't wake up inside.
I can't wake up.
Save me. So until then, when we get all evanescency with Desmond, where can people find more of your work online? Let's start this week with Joanna Robinson.
Oh, hi. You can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can find me at VanityFair.com. You can follow. I already said the Twitter part. You can listen to me on the podcast Little Gold Men, where we are talking about It Happened One Night, a great film this week, and also Still Watching, where we have two special guests in the form of Mark Bernardin and Daniel Kibble-Smith on Still Watching Loki. So there you go.
And Mr. Neil Miller.
Well, you know, you can always get me over at filmschoolrejects.com or on Twitter at Rejects or at One Perfect Shot. That's also me. I'll keep plugging the fact that Dave and I are going to be on Screen Drafts, mostly because we've already recorded it, so I know that it's going to happen. I just don't exactly know when it's going to be live, but we had a very fun discussion about legacy sequels, so keep your eyes out for that one.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez, also on that Screen Drafts podcast with Neil that will eventually be out. But you can also find me on Twitter at DA7E and on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, which talks about different pop culture things with some of my friends. But also, you know, most importantly, here at the end of the show, usually last week there was a little bit more interview, but now again, once again, at the end of the show, telling you to not fall down.